Today is Wednesday. It's April 13th, 2022. It's now 2:38 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. You're listening to The Mincing Rascals. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Heather Sharon of WTTW News.
I'm Eric Zorn, the Wilson Weary publisher and editor of the Picayune Sentinel and occasional columnist for the Daily Herald.
I think I'm with you on that, Eric. I think a fair question is how reasonable is the Willie Wilson? That's what you're talking about, right?
Wilson Weary, yes, that's me. After three, this is his third mayoral campaign, plus his senatorial campaign, plus all his other campaigns. So, yeah, I'm tired of Willie Wilson.
And the question is, how seriously do you have to take him? He's a legitimate candidate. He's a good philanthropist. He has a constituent. Heaven help us if he becomes the mayor of Chicago. I know that sounds condescending, but I think you have to have certain credentials and abilities, and he doesn't have them. And in this cuckoo world, I'm like, oh, please. Please, not Willie Wilson. Is that wrong to say or think that?
No, John, it's not wrong to think that. I've never heard Willie Wilson articulate any policy proposals that really make any sense. I feel like he seems to be a good-hearted guy with his philanthropy, everything like that. But I've never heard him talk about issues in a way that makes me think like he has a command of what's going on. He has some solutions to problems. And I think he thinks that it's all going to be very simple. And I don't think he has the kind of presence, the kind of charisma that you would need to win a mayor's race.
His personal story is truly tremendous, and he is truly a generous, kind-hearted person. I also think perhaps there's maybe a Willie Wilson school of politics, whereby if he can command a certain share of votes and he can count on that, that actually gives him a great deal of or some influence with folks who may win or may want to make deals with him or for him to be a part of that administration. Obviously, he endorsed Lori Lightfoot's campaign. He's since rescinded his endorsement. But if he's commanding consistently 10%+ of the vote, people have to listen to him who are in positions of power. And maybe that's really the game rather than necessarily winning the whole thing.
Well, and of course, the story that he tells is that, you know, he did endorse Mayor Lightfoot over Tony Preckwinkle last time, and he says that he regrets that a great deal. And I think one reason that he regrets it is that Lori Lightfoot gave him the cold shoulder after she won. She won with, I think it was 74% of the vote. Is that right, Heather?
Yep, that's right.
And she probably thought, well, Willie Wilson's 10% of the vote, I don't need that. And that may turn out to be a pretty serious miscalculation on his part.
Maybe politically, but do you think she owed him anything?
I think that she owed him, I don't know. I mean, she didn't need him, clearly. She won but with such a wide margin. Yeah. But a politically smart mayor would have said, like, I'm going to keep this former opponent of mine close. I'm going to take his phone calls. I'll put up with him for, you know, 10, 15 minutes every couple of weeks in order that he doesn't run again, because he did get 11% of the vote, I think, something like that, 10 or 11% of the vote in the last general election. I think he finished fourth. And so he does have a constituency, and if he takes that constituency and either draws it away from Mayor Lightfoot or ends up giving it to somebody else, which was always a possibility, that could be really dispositive in this race that's going to have, you know, I don't know, maybe up to 10 candidates again. And I think it was just real political malpractice on the mayor's part not to at least pay him some attention and try to bring him into her fold rather than keep him out.
I would just say that I covered his announcement and interviewed him for Chicago Tonight. It would be a long shot for anyone who is not a member of the Democratic Party to be elected mayor of Chicago, and he is not a member of the Democratic Party. I think he declined three times to tell me whether he thought that Joe Biden was properly and fairly elected president of the United States. He also said that it wasn't anybody's business who he voted for in 2020. And he said, look, I'm running for mayor of Chicago. I'm not running for president. And I just think that we should not underestimate the moment of peril that our democracy is in, that that is somehow an answer that a candidate for mayor of Chicago is giving to reporters.
I don't care who you voted for president. I don't know that that is my business. But when you asked him, didn't you ask him, wasn't one of his answers, how should I know if Joe Biden won? And I'm like, that's the answer that bothered me, Heather. That was the one that bothered me.
Because he voted for Donald Trump in 2016 and now says that he regrets that vote, and he says that he regrets voting for Lori Lightfoot, I think it's reasonable to ask, hey, well, what decision did you make this time around? There have been two instances where you've admitted you made the wrong call. It is a relevant question.
He's one of those guys that is articulating all of the things that we all don't like. This is what Mancow did when he first started, like the taxes and the crime and all of that. And you say, well, what's your plan? They go, well, not on my watch. By golly, I'll fix it. But Heather, you may check out before this podcast is done, and I want to make sure we also get to some of your reporting about the casino options for the city of Chicago, which we have been talking about on this podcast. And one thing I don't think we've spent much time on is aldermanic prerogative. Is that what they call it, aldermanic prerogative?
What they call it.
Which is the prerogative granted to city alder people. If it's in your ward, the council tends not to vote against your will. So whatever the harm or good of an idea, the city council usually doesn't go against the wishes of the local alderman. Mayor Lori Lightfoot does not like aldermanic privilege. And guess what? As I understand it, the aldermen in the wards where the casinos would go to the person aren't on board. None of them wants it in their backyard. Is that right?
So it's a little bit complicated when it comes to Walter Burnett in the 27th Ward. He has said he's open to having a casino on what is now the Chicago Tribune printing plant and newsroom, but he certainly hasn't endorsed the proposal, saying quite clearly that he wants to get everything possible out of the casino proposal for his residents before fully backing it. The other two proposals are in Alderman Sophia King's 4th Ward. This is the area over the train tracks west of Soldier Field that would become the one central development, and the Hard Rock Casino would be part of that. And then there's the 25th Ward, represented by Alderman Byron Sikcho-Lopez, where the Rivers Rush Street Gaming proposal would build the River 78 Casino south of the Loop and then north of Chinatown.
Yeah.
And Byron Sikcho-Lopez is firmly against this proposal. And he has the support of some groups in Chinatown that are worried that a casino in such close proximity to Chinatown would be really problematic for members of Chicago's Asian American community who have struggled in greater numbers with problematic gambling and gambling addiction. And he just doesn't think it's right for the 78, which of course is supposed to become Chicago's 78th community area because we have 77 now. I always have to explain that because people don't understand what that is.
I didn't.
See, there you go. For a long time, Rush Street Gaming was thought to have the inside track here because it's led by Neil Bloom, who is a hometown Chicago billionaire. He runs the Des Plaines Rivers Casino. His family is close with Mayor Lori Lightfoot. She went to college with his daughter. They are prolific campaign contributors to her. And it's true of Chicagoans, myself included, that we like doing business with people who are from Chicago. So if the casino then goes on the 78, that means that Mayor Lori Lightfoot would have to ask the city council to basically reject aldermanic prerogative in just the most high profile way ever. Even if members of the city council don't really care that Byron Sikcho-Lopez doesn't want this casino, they do not want to set a precedent where the mayor could put something in their ward that they do not want. So I think she would be hard pressed to find 26 votes to do that. There are a lot of people who are now looking at these proposals and saying, that's a lot of traffic, or wow, that's quite an impact along the Chicago River. I don't know if we signed up for all of that. And while they might like it in theory, you and I, we all know that, you know, not in my backyard tends to.
I'm thinking of that. I'm thinking NIMBY, but I'm so, yeah. So answer this. This will sound very like I'm some sort of tyrant, but I'm like, okay, I know you don't want it in your backyard. Too bad. We do. It's almost, I have an almost eminent domain attitude about this sort of thing, where if it's for the greater good of the community, then too bad for you.
I don't know if you're a tyrant. I mean, you're basically sort of playing Sim City and just dropping things and little areas, roller coasters,
yeah, I am.
Whatever game you want. Yeah, I mean, selfishly, I don't want it to be on Halsted by that Tribune site, because that's my bike route into the loop, and it's really, there's no one there because it's barren right now, and it's pretty good on that stretch of Halsted. It's mm-hmm. fine. So if there's a casino there, it would become harder. No, I think this is a case of the confluence of a lot of busted things about Chicago city government all coming together at once. So one, there's this horrible financial situation, and specifically, the mayor will want at any turn the ability to have more revenue to play with. Now, for aldermen, I think the overriding concern will not be, oh, I can have more money to spend in the city budget, because most aldermen aren't really directly involved in these issues of citywide importance. What they are directly involved in is their constituents complaining to them about traffic and potholes and all that stuff. So you can see how in a system like that, you're going to have, with any decision, a handful, likely small, with any development decision, of aldermen who say, this is going to cause me to lose my election if you do this. So in our system, they get complete veto power over anything that scares them in that way. That's what aldermanic prerogative really is. Now, you have that intersecting with the fact that we have these politically drawn maps, and there's going to be all sorts of horse trading about what those maps are going to be that doesn't have the interests of any residents in mind. I mean, is there any clearer example of that than this, where you're going to take a vacant plot of land and put it in one alderman's ward versus another? What are voters like really demanding that in any way? I don't think that's a reflection of voters' wishes. It's political wishes. Ultimately, I think in other cities, this would be something that is decided by sort of a professional planning commission. Mm. You might have some kind of referendum. You would want to have city residents weigh in on, hey, should we have a casino or not? But instead, in Chicago, it's going to be all backroom dealing. Residents will have very little voice in whatever happens and where the casino goes.
I have a couple of questions for Heather. One is, there are sort of two new ward maps that are out there that are being contested. Is Alderman Dowell in the 78 ward in both of those map proposals? No,
only the Black caucus, the map supported by the Black caucus. The map supported by the Latino caucus and Alderman Sigcho Lopez keeps the 78 in the 25th ward. So this will be sort of one of the big issues that is decided by either a compromise in the next month, or B, a referendum of Chicago voters.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. The other question I have is, I'm not clear, the 78, is that Neil Bloom's casino proposal? No.
Right. That's yeah. where it would be. Now, the 78 okay. overall is from Related Midwest, which is partnering with Rush Street Gaming. And the 78 is a mixed use development that has already sort of signed a deal with the University of Illinois to basically bring a tech incubator to part of that land. So it's going to be homes and shops and businesses, as well as this University of Illinois facility and this entertainment district and casino and resort. On land that has been vacant for pretty much my entire life, a massive, huge development with huge part of it as a potential casino.
And do I remember correctly, or wasn't there an aldermanic prerogative fight when they were going to move the Children's Museum from Navy Pier into Grant Park? And correct. The alderman there was opposed to it. And I believe it was Mayor Daley at the time, right? Who said, we're going to do this. But then that whole everything about that plan went away. I don't remember exactly why, but I do remember that aldermanic prerogative was at stake then. So this isn't the first time that we've had this fight. I also remember that Mayor Lightfoot campaigned on getting rid of aldermanic prerogative.
Yeah.
And
oh, yes, she did. And she mentioned it in her inaugural speech.
And I actually don't fault her for failing to get rid of it, because I just don't think that politically that was going to happen, for the reasons that Heather's already articulated.
But that's not codified in any way, right? There's no law. No, this is just the way it's done in Chicago, right, Eric?
Yes. I mean, Heather's the one who would be the one to ask that question, but I believe that that's true, that it's never been written down. It's just always understood.
It's mostly unwritten, but the zoning code is basically where the heart of this power lies. So the zoning code could be, and the mayor has said it should be, rewritten to prevent this from happening. And when I say that there has been no attempt to do that, I mean less than a zero attempt to do that. Because every time the mayor has made sort of a small incursion in this greater war, like with business signs or anything, you know, sort of remotely related to, we needed an alderman to sign off on this before we could do it, the city council has joined forces and with one voice nearly pushed back against her and forced her to revise those plans.
So every alderman has veto power then over the mayor, correct, or even the better intentions of the city council. If for, correct, whatever reason that one person, how messed up is that?
This is a system that doesn't exist in this form really in any other big city. There's always going to be some kind of local control over decisions like this. But Chicago, more than any other place, has this really and antiquated Byzantine system where you have these little strongman rulers in their ward that decide everything. And you get into this trick box because I remember when we released our book, The New Chicago Way, and we're talking at, like, you know, a library on the Southwest side, and people talk, when we talk with people about aldermanic privilege, and then it's almost, it's such a cultural shock to people that they wouldn't be able to go to their alderman with some kind of ticky-tack complaint about something that's happening in their ward. And what you have to kind of remind them and remind aldermen of is, if you take that power out of the alderman's office, it's not as if no one's accountable. It's simply that it's out of the hands of just a single person and it's sort of professionalized. But that can be a bit scary. My plea, though, to aldermen would be, if you divest this power from yourselves, yeah, you're not going to be able to, you know, shake down developers to get what you want. But also your constituents, you're not then beholden to every constituent complaint about something in your ward, which is a horrible existence. Like no one should want that job. Everyone coming to them with every little thing that's happening in their ward. And then just the last thing on the casino, I think, you know, when we talk about a fair map, there's lots of talk about sort of communities of interest and historical cultural lines. Under the auspices of that, I think it would be fair to put the casino at the 78 because of its historical lineage of being the owned by the corrupt Blagojevich associate Tony Rezko. And that area was called Rezkoville before it was called the 78. So I think we should return it to its corrupt roots.
It's not exactly a ringing endorsement. You know, about the communities, though, that would say, hey, it's going to create so much congestion, it's going to change our lifestyle, and God forbid we interrupt Austin's bike ride in the morning, so nobody wants it, right? We wouldn't have anything. We wouldn't have. Have you tried to park at Soldier Field on the day of a Bears game? No, it's a nightmare. It's terrible. That's just what happens with big cities and congestion in densely populated areas. I guess my point is, I think that's a fair complaint, but I don't think it's bulletproof.
And it ends up hurting the rest of the city. And I think the most clear consequence of this is in housing, where if you want to build really dense, I'm in Lincoln Park right now. If you want to build something really dense, because a lot of people want to move to Lincoln Park and you want to have housing for those people, even if they're well off, you want to be able to build housing for those people. Because if you don't, guess where they're jacking up the rent in other communities where people who are there and have been there for years cannot afford. So the fact it's not deferring to the will of one person at the expense of many, many other Chicagoans.
That's why I want to be king someday, because you just need somebody who's fair and just, oversees. They go, wow, it's going to suck for you guys. It's going to be good for these guys. And guess what? For the greater good, we're going to have a casino there. I'm not an advocate of gaming per se. I'm not, you know, but I'm just an advocate of this kind of a development. I don't know if the actual buildings will look anything like the proposals. I think they look pretty swell, and I don't think any of them are going to tarnish the landscape.
Your listeners are not in favor, though, right, John?
They always
say. What are the reasons for not being in favor?
If you said, hey, would you like fresh drinking water? They'd go, I don't know. I don't know. What really? What's that going to cost us? No, I think that's the fallback.
In their defense, I mean, there is something sort of tawdry about a lot of casinos in this country, and you don't want it to be some sort of a second-rate Vegas Strip in Atlantic City type place. It's not the image that Chicago wants. And to get back to what Heather was talking about, how this happened very quickly in the General Assembly, it happened very quickly, but after like 25 years of civic discussions about casinos in Chicago. I can remember that these conversations going on in the 90s, certainly, maybe even before that, where we were debating, do we want a casino? And it never went anywhere in the General Assembly. And then it was just like not happening. And then suddenly it happened like that. And Heather's exactly right. We never had one of these civic conversations, these debates, maybe even a referendum. Do we want this in Chicago? It went from impossible to fait accompli very quickly.
Well, I'm glad that your reporting, Heather, included the fact that at those 3 2-hour sessions, the total amount of time dedicated to community input, where they get to talk to the developers, was in sum about 2 hours, maybe less.
Right.
That feels a little rushed.
For many, many years, it was blocked by Rahm Emanuel, who opposed a casino. And then it was blocked by Bruce Rauner, who basically didn't want Chicago to get any extra revenue because he and Rahm Emanuel were at loggerheads and would sooner see the other one bleed to death than offer a Band-Aid. And then with the election of J.B. Pritzker and then Mayor Lightfoot, it sort of all came together very, very fast. Plus, we can't overlook the fact that the Democrats had supermajorities in both the Illinois House and the Illinois Senate, which meant that whatever anybody wanted got done, essentially. It's also, I think, important to emphasize that this has been essentially touted by city officials as sort of the solution to Chicago's financial problems. Without a Chicago casino, they say, Chicago faces financial ruin and peril, and, you know, all sorts of terrible things are coming. And that framing of the discussion makes it really hard to have a debate about whether a casino is appropriate, because then the response is, well, how do you want Chicago to pay its bills? Do you not want to have police services anymore? Do you not want to have fire services anymore? Whether, you know, we're talking about like, hey, is this what we want for Chicago as a city?
Yeah. I think we're fools if we think that this is going to solve all of our financial problems anyway. I'm advocating for it, it sounds like. I guess I am, but not because I see it as some sort of cure-all.
You didn't notice when marijuana revenue fixed all the problem?
You know what I'm looking at right now is the amount of revenue that the state garnered from gaming on the NCAA basketball tournament. $246 million was legally spent by Illinoisans in the month of the March Madness tournament. $246 million, of which I'll pull the number up here in a second, but of which I think Illinois was able to capture about $14 million. Hooray, we got betting on college basketball, but it seems to me like that's a bad deal. I don't know how much money this thing is really going to throw off. Is it known if what the best case projections are for a casino in Chicago?
It's essentially going to bring in somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 million in the sixth year that the casino is operating.
How much?
$200 million.
Yeah, that's more than 14.
Now, the projections say that the most lucrative casino would be the one proposed by Bally's at the Chicago Tribune printing plant and newsroom. And that is essentially because Bally's has no other casinos anywhere in the Chicagoland area. Hard Rock has a Gary, Indiana casino. And of course, Rivers has the Splains casino. So the city study says, look, Bally's would have all of the incentive to drive all of their marketing efforts towards the Chicago casino, whereas the other firms may face sort of split loyalties.
Austin, there's a new law in Illinois. Gas stations. Is this proposed or is this in fact been
this
signed by the governor?
Awaiting signature by the governor.
Awaiting the signature by the governor. Gas stations will have to pay a fine if they do not post signs saying that the state has suspended the inflation adjustment for the motor fuel tax. Taxes aren't going to go up as a result of this, and they want to make sure that not only does that happen, but that, I guess, drivers and voters know that. So it'll be incumbent upon the gas station owners to post a sign with the details.
I think just how the remap fight is being sort of played to get a casino in Chicago being the most Chicago politics thing ever. I think this thing is like the most Illinois politics thing ever. So J.B. Pritzker and Illinois Democrats and some Illinois Republicans voted in 2019 to double the state gas tax. Not only did they double the state gas tax from 19 cents to 38 cents a gallon, they also included automatic increases in perpetuity. So we don't have to take this politically unpopular vote again. We're just going to increase the gas tax every single year to adjust with inflation. What this budget does, and J.B. Pritzker and Illinois Democrats were really crowing about, was, hey, we're freezing the gas tax. And I think in people's head, they think that means, oh, we're not going to have to pay the gas tax. No, it just means you pay the same gas tax, and we're going to they're delaying for 6 months the automatic increase. So J.B. Pritzker originally in his budget said, we're going to not have this increase the entire year. And then in 2023, we'll have another increase. The private sector unions who get all the contracts to build the roads freaked out and lobbied heavily. And now we don't even get a delay. We don't even get a pause for a year. There's just going to be two gas tax hikes next year. So there's going to be one in January, and then there's going to be another one in July. So in their magnanimous generosity to Illinoisans, they are requiring every single gas station on every single pump to put a little sign that says the following. As of July 1st, 2022, the state of Illinois has suspended the inflation adjustment to the motor fuel tax through December 31st, 2022. The price on this pump should reflect the suspension of the tax increase. If you don't do this, you get a $500 a day fine. So if you are an Illinois gas station owner who is not interested in giving sort of free political advertising to the ruling class of Springfield from July 1st, when this goes into effect, until Election Day, you will be subject to $65,000 in fines. So just to reiterate, they hiked the gas tax in 2019. They hiked the gas tax in 2020.
Yeah.
They hiked the gas tax in 2021. Yeah. No notice to anyone at the pumps. Now we're going to pause it and hike your gas taxes twice next year. We got to tell everybody at the pump that we're doing.
Well, and the wording on the sign, I think, is fairly confusing to most people. It's like, oh, wait a minute, they're suspending the inflation adjustment.
Yeah, what does that mean?
What does that mean? And what it means in real life is about 2 cents a gallon, I believe, is the amount that you won't be paying. You won't be paying that extra 2 extra cents. You're not going to notice a diminishment. Now, there's a little bit of precedent for this. Back in 2000, when the gas tax was 19 cents, the Republicans, Governor Ryan at the time, they got rid of the entire sales tax for 6 months. I think it was 6 months, in order to fight fuel prices that were getting up closer to $3 a gallon, and people were freaking out. And they required the sign on the pump, and the rationale they had then was, well, we don't want the gas stations to be continuing to charge the same amount and not giving that 19 cents per gallon back to the customers. So it's a slightly more of a rationale for it than there is for this one, where you wanted to make sure that. Now, I don't think that would actually have been a problem, because gas stations are notoriously competitive in price, and if one guy across the street lowers his price by 19 cents, the other station is going to lower their price by 19 cents. So I don't think that would have been a problem. I think it was grandstanding back then. But the Illinois Fuel and Retail Association, which is threatening to sue over this, and yeah, they will probably win, they did not take action back then, even though they told me that they were not happy about it. So this is something that Illinois politicians like to do. They like to put their names on things. Remember when Blagojevich put his name on the tollway and everything? It's like, this is reflex with politicians. They like to make sure that you know what's going on. This seems to me to be, first of all, it's such a small thing to be crowing about. It's hypocritical, because they didn't put a sign on the pump 2 years ago or 2019 saying, hey, guess what? We're doubling your gas tax.
Hey, don't beat up the gas station owner because your gas just went up a lot,
right,
because of what we
right
did.
Yeah. Right. And ultimately, it's probably going to be expensive to taxpayers, because we're going to have to pay for the legal defense, because I suspect that the state will go to court to defend this prerogative. So it's just such a bad idea. And one other thing I want to point out, which is that there's a similar requirement in the law, in the bill, for grocery stores. The grocery tax has been eliminated for an entire year, from July 1st this year to July 1st next year. It's a 1% grocery tax. We're one of a dozen states or so that has a grocery tax. We're getting rid of ours for a year. And they're supposed to put a similar sign up in the grocery store or alert you on their cash register receipt. But the thing is, and I misled you on this on the radio the other day, John,
yeah,
there is no fine. specified for that. That is just like a suggestion, I guess, because there's no.
Hey, here's a good idea. Well,
yeah. So it's got all kinds of problems with it, and as Austin says, it's Illinois politics for you.
Well, if I was a gas station owner, I would hire Austin to write the language that's going to go on the sign. Like if it has to have some of those words per se, the state has suspended the inflation adjustment of the motor fuel tax. I would say, hey, guess what, guys? The stupid politicians who think you're an idiot have now said this, but guess what? You're still going to pay twice next year, and we didn't have to tell you when they were raising the prices. So just so you know, are you with me? Are you writing this down, Austin?
John, you read my mind. So we are actively working on doing this.
Oh, really? Illinois Policy Institute.
We'll do it. And we've been talking with a number of people on how to distribute them. But the requirements, the law's not even written well. So the requirements are, it has to be at least 4 inches by 8 inches to sign. And then the text I read out, it just has to be in bold font. So you could have a huge sign that said, J.B. Pritzker hiked your gas tax in 2019, 2020, and 2021. And he's making us put up the sign about it by penalty of $500 fine, and then put the rest of it in fine print. And you would be completely in compliance with the law. So we will be making some alternative.
So you can have a 4x8 sign and has this language that you just discussed, and then in extremely small but bold type at the bottom.
Yeah.
It could be bold italic type. You could have this little notice about the
sort of like the user agreement on a website or something that, you know.
And I think that speaks to like, so this tax relief package, there's been a lot written about it. It's $1.8 billion in tax relief, but it's almost all temporary tax relief. And I think there's a case to be made that people are going to be more angry that they feel tricked that their tax hikes are coming after the election than they are grateful for any temporary relief. So I don't even know if this exercise was like a good political calculation.
Well, also, they're going to be like Willie Wilson regretting their vote.
Yes.
Well, the language on any of these things, when you're trying to convey something to the entire state, can be difficult. I mean, think about what it's like when there's a referendum on the ballot. Eric, you and Austin know about how delicate that was the last time we considered the fare tax hike.
I wish you wouldn't bring it up. It's the graduated income tax.
Pardon me, the graduated income tax. And then how do you describe
that? There's another complicated one this year, which I'm sure we'll be talking about.
What's that?
Later. There's what it's called, the proponents call it the Workers' Rights Amendment. And it's a big, we'll talk about it more.
Sounds really interesting, Austin. So there's a sign in front of the First United Church of Oak Park this Lenten season that reads, Fasting from Whiteness. Fasting from Whiteness. Pastor John Edgerton is only using music in his services for these 40 days from artists of color. He's received praise for that and threats about that. The sign comes down at night, he says, to keep it from vandals or shenanigans. He's white. Most of his congregation is white. Fasting from whiteness is his sort of attack on racism. He says it's not enough to simply do no harm. One must actively try to do good. And this is his form of activism. Eric, you've written about this. What do you think of his best intentions here?
I think his intentions are good. I think that the wording of the sign, the wording of the slogan is incendiary, perhaps unnecessarily so. Those of us who are white have been gorging on whiteness our entire lives, even if we don't want to admit it, that white privilege is a real thing, and let's not deny it. On the other hand, to put this in terms of fasting, there's almost no way that members of this congregation can renounce temporarily even the privileges and the advantages they've had for being white in our society their entire lives. And what they're doing is they're playing liturgical music from composers of color, and the pastor, I heard him interviewed on your show the other day, John, was saying that the music has never been better. It's great music. And I think it's wonderful they're doing that. And if they had just had this initiative like, well, we're going to be playing this music, no one would have even noticed or cared. That this slogan, I think, was probably deliberately provocative. And I went on Twitter, big mistake, I guess, to see what the response was to it. And it seemed like it was very overwhelmingly, they were either mocking them or being hostile to them. And but I do think that it does pay for white people to realize that you don't have to feel guilty about it, but the white privilege is a thing. And if we can do some things to overcome that in some ways to make people feel respected and welcome and to push that advantage back a little bit. I don't think that's a bad thing. Maybe in the long run, something like this will raise consciousness for people in a salutary way. But I think that the backlash to it may be worse than any advantage that they got. So
yeah,
that's some of my thoughts.
I think that's well put. And, you know, I asked him if he was being deliberately provocative, and he said no. But then he's either being dishonest or naive, because what kind of reaction do you think that's going to get? And I know Oak Park is very integrated and progressive, and they work at it. But come on.
So I think it's very on brand for Oak Park. Yeah. And I say that as, you know, a resident of the others on the suburbs on the other side. I think it's important that, you know, it be put in the context of Lent, which is a time in many Christian religions for fasting and sort of avoiding sweets and other things that are special treats and sort of a benefit. But if it makes people sort of stop and reconsider sort of the benefits that they've enjoyed unthinkingly, like, okay.
But the question is, does it do that too? Does it do
that? I think for some people it does. And I think that there are some people who will take it as an attack. And I think that some people taking it as an attack is sort of proves its point, you know, in and of itself.
That's very passive aggressive, though. I mean,
yeah.
That
would be very Catholic.
Well, but how persuasive is that, though? I mean, really, I think that when the guy was sitting down and tacking that sign up, I wonder if he thought, is this going to help or hurt the cause?
Well, I think it depends on what you want to do. Are you seeking to make people who are inclined to listen to what you say sort of rethink sort of how they approach life? Or are you attempting to make a larger point to people not in the congregation? You know, I don't know the answer to that question. But I think that Eric's experience on Twitter is probably a good one, that's not the place to go for nuanced discussion of this kind of thing.
Yeah, but really, a sign in front of your church as cars drive by is the motor vehicle equivalent of Twitter. You know, it's just a shout out, and then people have reaction. The first reaction I got from my listeners was, "Wait, so I did something wrong because I'm white now?" They get very defensive about that.
Ascribing general traits to quote unquote whiteness is, in my opinion, almost always a bad idea, and whether they are positive traits or negative traits. I remember, I think this was last year, maybe 2020, the National Museum of African-American History and Culture in DC, which I highly recommend people go to, had a flyer about this that caused a lot of controversy. And it was saying, it was talking about aspects and assumption of whiteness in the United States. And under this sort of catch-all of whiteness, it listed things like self-reliance, the nuclear family, father, mother, 2-3 children, objective, rational, linear thinking. That's the most racist thing I think I've ever seen. Like whiteness, like self-reliance is a trait of people with white skin. Nuclear family is a trait of people with white skin. Conversely, if you just ascribe negative traits to whiteness, or that it is something to fast from, like as if it's a thing in and of itself that just can be, you can put anything on, I think the reaction is totally going to be from people, please judge me on the content of my character. I can recognize that I've had advantages because of my skin color or my socioeconomic background or things of that nature. But if you're ascribing bad traits to a thing that I can't control, mm-hmm, I don't blame people for being very defensive of that.
As a practical matter, if the sign said we're welcoming communities of color and enriching our service with music we haven't played in the past, that doesn't roll off the tongue.
We can all agree white people should not only listen to music by white people. That would be good.
But what he was saying, what they were saying is that the music in the church has been predominantly composed by white composers. And so they made this shift. And it's the slogan that's got everybody excited about it and got everybody firing at them and so on, figuratively, I hope not literally. But I think it is important to remember that you don't have to be stereotyping people to say that it is an advantage in our society to be born white, just like there's an advantage, I think, to being male in our society. It's not, it doesn't mean that any one person is going to be have a particular advantage over others. But if you look upon your life right now and say, would I have been better off if I had been born a black or brown person in society, just everything else being equal? I think the way our society is structured and the way things have happened, the answer has got to be no. And that is a shame. It's not something that you yourself should feel guilty about, but it is something to be conscious of.
I wanted to get to Heather.
Heather's got a heart out.
I know that. And the next thing we want to talk about is the Solis thing. Can you set the stage for us before you go, Heather?
Sure. So Alderman Danny Solis, more than 3 years after we all learned that he had flipped and worn a wire on not only Alderman Ed Burke, but also former House Speaker Michael Madigan, finally got a day in court. He appeared by phone in front of a federal judge, and he was set to plead not guilty, which basically triggers the start of a deferred prosecution agreement that he entered into in December 2018. And that agreement basically says, we're going to charge you with bribery because you admit taking at least $15,000 from a firm that wanted to build an apartment complex in your ward and needed the support of the zoning committee that he was chairman of. And you took that money and you admit it. But we're not going to send you to jail, and we're not going to try to take your city pension in return for your substantial assistance in other ongoing probes. Now, that agreement does not mention Ed Burke or Michael Madigan, but we all know that that's what the substantial assistance Danny Solis provided was. And everything was going along as expected, with Danny Solis saying, yes, Your Honor, no, Your Honor. When one of the assistant U.S. attorneys told the judge in the case that the city of Chicago wanted to intervene in the case because the city's law department considered the city itself a victim of Danny Solis's crime. And just while we were taping this podcast, in fact, I finally got a response from the mayor's office saying that, yes, the city was going to seek to be allowed to enter a victim impact statement, saying that the entire city had been victimized by the fact that Danny Solis, while he was one of the most powerful people at Chicago City Hall, was basically taking bribes to do official actions, and that he deserves to be held accountable to the people of Chicago. Now, what's really interesting about this, besides the fact that Lightfoot is a former federal prosecutor, and so she understands sort of what was happening today, I think, better than your average mayor, is that there's really no provision for the city to be involved in this at all. And in fact, one of the assistant U.S. attorneys told the judge he was doubtful that the city could prove that it was a victim of whatever Solis has admitted doing. But the city is going to try to intervene. There's another hearing next week. And it is just the latest wild twist that this case that has really upended politics for time after time after time.
To what end? What does the city have to gain?
That's a good question. On March 10th, we had sort of learned a little bit more about what Danny Solis had done after Michael Madigan had been indicted, and Lightfoot unleashed. She said she was deeply offended that Solis was on track not to serve a day in prison, that he would keep his city pension after basically sort of engaging in just the most rampant corruption and graft for many, many years. And I think that this is an opportunity for the mayor, who, of course, we all expect to run for re-election next year, to indicate that she's frustrated that this is sort of the way this is all played out, and that he won't go to jail. There's not really anything the city can do.
Yeah.
Most legal minds say, a lot of times people will ask me, why can't we, you know, take that person's pension after they were convicted of wrongdoing? And then I tell them that the bar to take somebody's pension in Illinois is incredibly high. And I always point to John Birch, who, of course, led a crew of Chicago police officers who literally tortured and abused Black men for decades on the South and West sides. And he died collecting every penny he was entitled to from his city of Chicago pension. A more cynical person who writes for the opinion pages, like my friend Eric or Austin, might say that this is sort of political posturing because we're entering a political season and Lightfoot's brand has been sort of defined by her demand that corruption end at City Hall, and that this the fact that Solis isn't going to go to prison really sort of calls into question whether she's been able to make any significant dent in that corruption. But I'm not quite that cynical, and I don't share opinions. So there you go.
Heather Sharone with some reporting and commentary, even though she said she wouldn't make commentary on them. All right, you got to go, Heather. Thanks for your help today.
I do. Thanks.
Hi, Heather.
All right, so we're just left with the cynics now.
Well, I believe that this has got to be political posturing because, as Heather points out, Mayor Lightfoot is a former federal prosecutor. She knows how you get the big fish is you get the little fish to brat on them. So it doesn't bother me that much. Danny Solis, his life has been turned completely upside down by his offenses. He's not perhaps going to serve any time behind bars or pay any huge fines. But I think has he basically been in witness protection? Nobody knows really where he is, I don't think, anymore. So the idea that he's got off scot-free with this is wrong. And he's helped us. He's helped the citizens of Chicago and Illinois a great deal by bringing down some participating in the attempt to bring down some allegedly corrupt. Well, he's not a hero, but this is how it's done in law enforcement, right? I mean, if you couldn't offer these carrots to people to flip or to testify, it would be very hard to convict anybody.
Totally.
Particularly of corruption.
It is, though. So there's, on one hand, that totally makes sense. And you have to have a track record of actually protecting people who are helping law enforcement take down corrupt people, even if they themselves are bad. I would say the corruption being carried out perhaps by an Ed Burke or Michael Madigan was many times more in magnitude, perhaps, than Danny Solis, if we were to be able to quantify that in some way. So maybe the trade-off is good. If he doesn't go to jail, those other two guys do. But it's a really hard pill to swallow for Chicagoans who have seen their cost of living go up so much that this guy is going to have a six-figure tax-free pension paid for by them after being, a complete disgrace in his position in public office. So maybe there's a happy medium between those.
Well, couldn't he be prosecuted at the county level? I mean, I know it's not traditional for the Cook County State's Attorney to Kwame Raoul, the Attorney General, but the deal he has with the feds is not necessarily a deal that applies to other prosecutions, because once he is convicted of, I think it's got to be a felony, right? And it has to be connected to his service in office, which in this case clearly was, that you could get his pension back that way. I don't know if that would work or not, but that's
such a hot button issue. Those pension things, those lifelong pensions, make people crazy. You sometimes ask me, what do my listeners say about that? They hate that. Was Solis, this is a stupid question, but the Burger King parking lot that somebody wanted paved, was
that's Burke.
That was Burke.
That's, yeah, Burke.
Solis did wear a wire in talking with Ed Burke, as well as with Michael Madigan. And the most famous recording we have of him with Burke is Burke asking, did we land the tuna? Referring to the old Maine post office and shaking them down for his property tax appeals business. That came from a wiretap with Solis. And I believe, I might not have this right, but there were a couple of other, Solis was such an important node because he was chair of the zoning committee. So we were talking about this earlier, right? The people who are making those decisions about where these buildings are built and not, that was really the nexus that Danny Solis lived in, which is why he was so important to people like Ed Burke and Mike Madigan with property tax appeals business. Because Danny Solis, you have to come to the Don Danny Solis to get your thing built. What's Danny Solis in a position to ask you for? Hire Ed Burke's firm or hire Michael Madigan's firm. So you also had recordings of many developers that were perhaps had their taxes in a bad spot with the IRS. They were also recording conversations with a Burke or Madigan. And I think it was more from that end that you really got into the Burger King stuff with Burke.
Did we land the tuna?
Tuna. I think I work next to the old Maine post office and look at it every day and I think about the tuna.
Wow.
It doesn't even look like a tuna.
That sounds right out of Hollywood, doesn't it? Did we land a tuna? And by the way, here's the statement from the mayor's office about Alderman Solis. former Alderman Solis. There can be no doubt that former Alderman Solis violated the public trust in profound ways, not the least of which was by monetizing his position as zoning committee chairman for the benefit of himself and others, likely for years. Because of all of the crimes that have been put on the public record, Solis victimized the residents of his ward and residents of the entire city, all of whom were deprived the integrity and honesty that should be sacrosanct with all public officials. It's so hard to read that last part without chuckling. So that's the victim impact statement. This is the mayor's office saying, here's how the people were hurt, and therefore we should be as severe in our punishment. That's really all this is, right? It's a victim impact statement. Therefore, we should be as severe as possible in the punishment of Solis, right? Any last bits of wisdom, Eric, that you want to lay on us before we wrap it up?
Well, I just wanted to reiterate or point out that our fellow rascal Brandon Pope is starting his new show On the Block tomorrow at WCIU at 7 o'clock. And one of his reporters is going to be mincing rascal John Hansen. So Brandon and John have a show tomorrow starting at 7, and all rascal listeners should set their DVRs and watch it.
And they should continue to subscribe to Eric Zorn's Picayune Sentinel 2, which has how many? I was telling somebody the other day how this thing's taken off for you. Your weekly newsletter has how many subscribers now?
I'm approaching 10,000 subscribers. So that's, you know, it's a small newspaper these days. So,
yeah, no kidding. Yeah. And you're the sports department features. You're everything. Austin, anything you want to plug? Anything we can do for you here?
Listen to the America's Talking podcast. That's a podcast I started a few months ago. It's just me, 30-minute interviews with interesting people. I would also recommend highly a movie that I'm shocked no one's ever recommended to me. It's the best Chicago movie I've ever seen. Thief. 1981 Michael Mann film called Thief. It was Michael Mann's first film. It stars James Caan as a half-cocked safecracker in Chicago. He is joined by Jim Belushi and Willie Nelson. The soundtrack is by Tangerine Dream, which is a German electronic group in the 70s and 80s. I think it might be actually my favorite movie ever. It's definitely the best Chicago movie I've ever seen. I saw it on Saturday. Highly recommend. You can get it on Amazon Prime, I think.
Looking at my producer, Pete, our producer, Pete, because he and Justin Kaufman once did brackets, 64 films, best Chicago-based or Chicago-centric movie of all time. Pete, it was in the tournament. I'm not sure how it did. We'll have to dig out the old scrolls on that. Eric, have you seen that movie before?
I have not, but it's now on my list.
Yeah, no kidding, no kidding. All right, that's Eric Zorn, film critic Austin Berg. Thanks for Heather Sharon and the guys who are too busy with their TV shows to join us on the podcast lately, but that's okay. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. We'll drop in. Oh, by the way, even as we close, can I let my brother say hello to you guys? He's been sitting to my left. He is a patient viewer today, but a regular listener to the Mincing Rascals podcast. Mark, do you have anything you'd like to share with the Mincing Rascals here? You can use this microphone if you like.
This microphone doesn't work.
No, we don't want your microphone.
Is he your older brother or younger brother?
He's my
younger brother. I didn't get a good look at him.
It bothers younger me brother. That you had to ask that. But I'm his younger brother. Younger brother. A huge fan of both of yours.
Get closer to the microphone, Mr. Brussel.
I'm a huge fan of both of yours. And it's amazing to me how much Austin looks just like he sounds.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's like contemplative, you know, he's got the hat on and he just looks like he's thinking smart things and then they come out of his mouth. It's fun to listen to.
And he looks smart too, I guess that's what you're saying.
That's the compliment I've ever received.
And
there
also
was a guy who gave me a piece of feedback the other day who says, if there's anything I learned from dancing, it's you got to have an outfit. So like, sounds like good. I found my outfit.
And Eric, I'm a big fan. As you know, I'm a subscriber to the Picayune Sentinel. So John's not kidding when I will text him at 4 o'clock on Wednesday and say, when are the Rascals going to drop?
Yeah.
I enjoy it that much. And I just think you guys are fabulous. So.
Oh, thanks. That's really good to hear. It's really nice to know. And you don't live in the area, right?
I live in Phoenix, west of Phoenix in preseason baseball land.
So all our Chicago and Illinois politics stuff doesn't bore you?
A little bit. I mean, I certainly
that sounded so much like John.
I certainly enjoy it more when you guys run Trump into the ground. But we grew up in Joliet, so I've always considered myself a Chicagoan. So I'm 90% with you guys on all of the topics you talk about. Occasionally, when we start talking about too much alderman stuff that I just don't know anything about,
yeah.
But anyway,
yeah. But you know, when you got Heather explaining it to you, it's you feel like you're an insider. So.
That's for sure.
We have so many we have so many WGN radio listeners who are in Arizona, right?
Oh,
Chicagoans,
God, yes.
In Arizona. Maybe we should do a Phoenix update. You know, Phoenix aldermanic politics or something like that.
Phoenix has a great city government. I'll make a point on an episode to talk about how good Phoenix is. They have something called a 24-hour city, so you can get, they make it a point, you can get permits to start a business and do a bunch of different things in 24 hours in Phoenix.
Yeah, it's I have to say it's a pretty well-run city, pretty well-run state. You know, we have the advantage of weather, so the roads are always beautiful and the skies are always beautiful. So it's pretty easy to not fall all over yourself about parking and everything else. So, but it's a nice place to live.
Yeah, yeah. Cool.
And my brother was complaining about getting a parking spot to come here to the station and be part of the podcast today. He sends me a text going, where am I supposed to park? I'm like, I don't know, Mark. Find a spot. Go to a lot. Give somebody $25. He doesn't have Spot Hero because he's from Arizona. And that concludes this edition of the Mincing Rascals. We will drop another pod on you next week. Okay, boys. Thanks for being nice to my brother.
That was fun. Hey, thanks for the compliments. That was really nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. He means And I thought that was a really really good show today. Just lots of information as well as opinion, which is always good. So.
Yeah.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.